It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 233, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, catching rockets out of the air, a WordPress feud, and the Archive.org disaster.
It's another week. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Leo. How's it going?
It's going well.
Yeah.
It's been an exciting, you know, time for technology. It's funny. I did not watch it live, but I did watch the video of the most recent SpaceX Super Heavy launch.
Sure, yeah.
And what I find absolutely amazing is the catch, if you will, of the booster coming back. That was just amazing. Watching that, even delayed, sent a chill up my spine. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, so I saw it too. So I guess the idea was before they were doing, like, having it land, and that was proving to be too hard, or is this just a different technique for a different rocket?
I think they just decided this technique for a different rocket, but I'm not sure. I couldn't confirm that. I think up until now, they've just been assuming that booster, when used, would get tossed into the ocean, as has been traditional for the last 50 years.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder, like, what the details are engineering wise on the pressure put on by the chopsticks, you know, that caught it, and what extra convincing they have to do, or discounts you may get if you're actually riding one of those back up after it's been caught. It's like, you know, it's like buying a used car. You know,
slightly used, yes.
You know, hey, it's probably fine.
Yeah.
Climb on
board. What I was looking at, I could not get a good sense from the chopsticks or the arms that gathered it, but my sense is that they're probably not putting horizontal pressure on it. They're not squeezing the rocket, but instead they are positioning themselves underneath what I would just refer to as tabs that the rocket would then hang on or sit on. So,
That's probably it. You're probably right. So
it will be interesting to see, when this particular booster gets used again, what happens to it.
Yeah. Indeed.
I was thinking about it as I was watching it, and just, you know, from my perspective, from a software engineering perspective, I could just envision so many processors doing so much calculation in real time, adjusting the rockets and adjusting this, that, and the other thing. It's almost overwhelming how much computation is going into simply getting that sucker to line up in exactly the right place. When you think, it's no small feat, right? They had to get within a few inches of where they intended.
Oh, sure.
And the target was the planet. There's a lot of room for error. So
I'd like to think that the rocket itself was doing all of that with, as you said, tons of processors and trying to figure it out. But meanwhile, the catching device is basically just a guy named Dave with his fist over a big red button that just is like, is it there? Yes, boom. And then it closes. You know, because why not?
Sure, why not, indeed. Dave, don't screw it up.
Yeah, press the button at the right time. I mean, because it probably is just a trigger, but I'm sure they do have, I'm sure it's automatic systems and all of that. It's interesting. It's also interesting to see it fire, you know, just like the ones that land, you know, they're firing just before they hit the ground to slow down. So that means that they're not using all the rocket fuel to actually boost whatever, you know, the cargo is up.
Correct.
Yep. Some of it's being kept in reserve. And that's kind of interesting from, like, you know, just thinking in terms of all those math problems you have to do when you're in math, physics class, trying to figure out, like, the weight of the fuel and its decreasing amount over time versus the amount of force being applied and all of
that.
For
some reason, I went to the old problems of, you know, if a rocket goes up at this speed for this long and then needs to turn around and come down at this speed and that long, how much has to be left before it falls to the ground out of fuel?
Yeah, exactly. It's further complicating the whole equation, but that's where we're at. And you know, it's good. A lot of rockets go up every year now. It's pretty incredible.
Hopefully. And indeed, the only thing that worries me now about the increasing pace at which we're throwing things into orbit, is that there's a lot of things in orbit, and
Sure.
There's a name for it. It doesn't come to the tip of my tongue, but there's a name for it where a chain reaction could happen where one thing in orbit crashes into another, and then that
Yeah.
sends off all sorts of pieces, then crash into others and into others and into others. So hopefully.
Yeah, it's a lot, it's three-dimensional space, so there's a
Yes.
lot of room for error
Oh,
because
absolutely.
everything's in slight, even things that are in the same orbit aren't, may still be at quite a distance from each other when they pass each other, because it's, the same orbit might still be hundreds or thousands of feet or meters away when they pass. It's just kind of in the big scale of things, especially from the low Earth orbit or the extreme low Earth orbit of like the Starlink type satellites, compared to the extreme orbits of the geosynchronous satellites that have to stay stationary. But it's an incredible distance, and there's all sorts of different types of orbits in between that. There's a lot of space out there, literally. So yeah, hopefully that won't be an issue anytime soon. We have a lot of other issues to deal with, like actually, what happens when the space station is decommissioned and things like
I believe
that.
they even have a plan for that one, though.
Yeah, I've heard that they're planning what's going to be a series of private or semi-private space stations that NASA will actually lease space on.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so we'll see if that
I
how
did see
that
that
goes.
there was a news article about a space station potentially going up next year. That is essentially a luxury hotel. And for the right price, which was not mentioned, and of course, if you have to ask, it's, I mean, it's like it looked gorgeous. I'm not sure that I'd sit on top of a rocket to get there, but that's another piece of where things are headed. So,
Yeah, I was interested, just before we get off of the space thing, I was interested to see like how many people are in space right now. And there's a website,
Yes.
whoisinspace.com. And there are, believe it or not, 14 people, and I
Yeah.
think they're all on the International Space Station right now.
Does that not include? That's got to
Oh,
include
no,
the
that's
Chinese
two
space
space
station.
stations.
Yeah,
Yes, the
yeah.
Chinese one. Three are on board that, and the rest 11 are on board the ISS. So interesting. So yeah, we can't forget about the Chinese space station.
Yeah.
And it's we have to remember too, when the ISS started, I mean, it grew quite a bit over time. So while the Chinese space station is like would assume is smaller now because it's newer, it will probably continue to grow. I mean, it's pretty incredible. The 11 people on board the ISS. Because it seemed like so for so long in the early days of it was always like a crew of like three or four or something. Yeah, or
Two,
two.
three. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, and then to be fair, two of the ones that are up there right now are unplanned.
Yeah, they're not supposed to be. Yeah, they've overstayed
Yeah.
their
So,
yeah. Yeah.
anyway, so it's been an interesting week in
Yes.
technology. Otherwise, there have been a couple of interesting controversies and problems. The one that I want to bring up first, and this is one of those behind the scenes kind of things, I think, for a lot of people. But there is currently a bit of a feud going on between WordPress and WP Engine. WP Engine is essentially a hosting service where you can, set up your website, and it's designed to give you, managed for you WordPress installations, and that's how you would run your website or your blog or your whatever. Unfortunately, they've apparently gotten into a tiff with the actual WordPress folks, and the WordPress organization, mostly Matt Mullenweg, has essentially denied access to some of the technologies at WordPress.org that WP Engine might rely on. Now, that doesn't prevent anything from working, but apparently it does impact dramatically their ability to update, patch things and make updates as things move forward. And of course, in fine 21st century tradition, they're in the process of suing one another. So And of course, on the WordPress.org site, really there's, to be clear, there's WordPress.com and WordPress.org. WordPress.com is a place where you can set up your own free blog. And it's actually also used for authentication in a few other places. WordPress.org is a place where the open source WordPress software is available for anyone. For example, Ask Leo uses WordPress that I originally started with by downloading it from WordPress.org. It's unclear how this affects any of them other than reputation, other than the fact that, you know, WordPress.org or WordPress, all of it seems to have gone a little bit, I don't know, odd, political. It's not political in the governmental sense, but political in the technological sense. And that's kind of concerning. The bottom line for me is that while I'm certainly not panicking, because I don't really think that if there's going to be any major impact at all, it's going to be quite some time off. But it does kind of illustrate to me how fragile some things are. If I was hosting on WP Engine right now, I would be concerned, because they now have to take some extra steps to basically deal with whatever it is they're no longer able to access from WordPress. And that's concerning. The fact that I'm on the other side, self-hosted, doing my own stuff, means I'm pretty isolated or insulated from all of that. But for other folks, yikes. And there's also this undercurrent of, you know, WP Engine exists. And as it turns out, WordPress owns a competitor to WP Engine. So how much of this is competitive? How much of this is anti-competitive? There's just a whole lot of complications going on here. And it's honestly, it's kind of sad, because I've seen WordPress as being a wonderful example of how open source software and the community can really make a huge difference. You know, some, like, I think it's over a third of websites are running on WordPress. I think you've at least got one of yours doing it.
Oh, well, yeah, MacMost is WordPress, yes.
And I've got, you know, all my other sites, I can't even keep track. I've probably got about a dozen sites that are all running WordPress in various flavors. So it's pretty amazing what WordPress has done. And this is just kind of, even the most successful sites and services can't run into problems that make you wonder.
Yeah, it's very strange. I don't know much about WordPress, WP Engine at all, but I do know that I've been concerned about WordPress for a long time, in that not WordPress itself, but the whole community of plugins and themes and everything seems to just be just a deck, you know, a house of cards that just fall in on itself, because so many WordPress sites out there are so poorly put together, not because WordPress is, like, the engine at the center is great. Mm-hmm. It's just that you start adding things onto it. It's meant to be extremely expandable, which is exactly what's happened. So there are dozens of major systems that you could add to them. And you can either use one of those, and they're huge, and they basically change WordPress drastically, or you could just find tons of little ones. And I know people that have literally hundreds of these little plugins, and it just, every one you add adds more points of failure. And I've seen other people's WordPress installs, and they're scary. And quite frankly, my WordPress install should be scary to other people, because I not only have a very small number of plugins do some specific things, and I have my own plugin that does everything else. Right. So instead of actually expanding it by grabbing other people's stuff, mm-hmm. I have used my own skills as a programmer to expand it, which to me makes everything seem really stable and rock solid. But somebody else looking at it would say, I have no idea what that part is, because nobody except me does. Right?
Do you happen to know offhand how many plugins you actually do have installed? Because I'm looking at my number and I feel really guilty about it. But before I share it, I want to know what I'm up against.
I think I've got, I'm going to say like 6 or 7.
Man.
I mean, it's not that many. And let's see, the number of plugins I've got is 1, 2, 3. Well, actually, okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. But one of them is the classic editor, which is
Oh, right.
part of WordPress, really. It's not, it doesn't really count. One of them is mine,
Right.
right? And then the rest are that out of those, two of those are kind of anti-spam or anti, just stopping, get bad comments. And one's like limits login attempts. And I've got a
So,
cache, I've got everybody, a cache one and a one that will like attempt to put a list of like related posts on the page.
oh,
That's
right. Yeah.
it.
I had one of those for a while. It really wasn't doing a good job for me.
Yeah, I don't like it.
I have 45 plugins turned on right now.
Ooh.
And one of them is mine, one of them is Classic Editor, like you said. But the one of the I think the big differences here is that I'm using, well, I have my own self-hosted store. I'm using it for membership stuff. I'm using it for some communication stuff. I mean, I'm just doing a whole bunch of stuff with this site. And it's unfortunate because some of that stuff could be parceled out to other sites, right? A better, perhaps less fragile design would have me set up the, like my membership site on a different server. But the ease with which things can work kind of implies that they're working together and they're all working together on the single WordPress install. But yes, yeah, so I've got the same, I've got the anti-spam plugin, I've got SEO plugin, I've got a bunch of other things that a security plugin, a couple of those. Yeah, it's and the other thing, the store that I run, I use WooCommerce for that. Which is the same model, actually, kind of sort of as WordPress, as in and in that there's a base WooCommerce, which is actually free. But if you actually want to do some of the other things that go beyond what that base offers, well, there's a plugin for that. So, if I look at this, I've got WooCommerce, but then I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 additional plugins that are all related to WooCommerce, which is pretty amazing. Anyway, so not only is it necessarily, fragile on the inside, I mean, I agree with your concerns, but yikes.
Yeah, 45. Yeah, it's a lot. It seems to be, but then not a lot compared to some of the stuff I've seen. So, there's that. And
One of the
speaking
things
of.
that makes me feel a little bit better about having all these plugins is now understanding how plugins work. Because, like you, I've got my own custom plugin that does a few things specifically for me. And, understanding how it hooks in, understanding what does and what does not impact the system, is actually good knowledge to understand what you should and shouldn't do with plugins in general.
Yeah, indeed. A lot of people keep their customizations in their theme, and I actually may have a few of those as well where it seemed appropriate to put them in the theme rather than that. And I have my own custom theme as well, which I created from the kind an old version of the WordPress default theme. Old because that's when I created it. But
All right.
it was new when I made it. So yeah, I've got my own custom theme as well, which is another thing. People have tons of themes installed, and themes aren't as simple as just a list of colors and font sizes. There's functionality in the themes, and sometimes it can even be dangerous to have a theme you're not using kind of sitting there. So yeah, I just have those. And speaking of fragile, it brings us to our next story, which is just a really disturbing one. Everybody should be disturbed about this. So, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, website on the internet has been having trouble the last week or so. Archive.org, of course, is what I'm referring to. It is a big site. I'm surprised to hear so many people constantly saying archive.org, the Wayback Machine, which I just it's like that's a small part of archive.org, but it's a part that a lot of people kind of remember and check out and think is neat or
Probably the
whatever.
piece that most people use, to be honest.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's like not for me and not for like it's not I mean I do use it occasionally, but I use other parts of archive.org more. But anyway, so sometimes in the press it's reported as the Wayback Machine is down or the Wayback Machine's been hacked. Well, it's actually archive.org, you know, saying like the Wayback Machine is the what's going on here. That's like saying the new books section of your library has been hacked. You know, it's like, well, actually the whole library's been hacked, the whole thing. So two things related happened. One is that denial of service attacks started on archive.org. So in other words, lots of computers, mostly like zombified computers with viruses on them, started hitting the server really hard. That started first, but they were able to deal with it. And I'm surprised, I would have thought that archive.org was the site that couldn't be attacked that way, simply because they deal with such a massive amount of bandwidth that I thought, well, anybody trying to attack it, it would be like a drop of water in the ocean kind of thing.
But I suspect that
turns out,
that massive bandwidth probably makes it more difficult for them to put in mitigation of any
probably
sort.
Yeah, it's harder to figure out, like, oh, you know, when they're, but apparently yes, you can overwhelm even them, and that's what happened. But they were able to kind of deal with it with some outages, and then they were hacked, and a database of passwords was stolen. And a message was put up on the site. So it was a real hack. It wasn't just like somebody got a hold of some data. They actually inserted some code into the site. They dealt with that, or at least the immediate dealing with it. There's going to be a long-term dealing with it as well. And then the denial of service attacks just ramped up to the point that it knocked archive.org offline completely for several days. And at this point, all they've done, been able to do is get the Wayback Machine portion of archive.org back up as read-only.
Right.
And that's been up for a day or two now, but the rest of archive.org, which contains, you know, like archives of human knowledge, you know, from books to web to, like, you know, documents to audio, video, I mean, just tons of stuff. It's like the world's, it's our modern day Library of Alexandria.
Right.
That is still offline, as I guess they are probably putting some things in place to shore it up, and hopefully it'll be back online soon. The weird thing about both of these attacks, assuming that they are related and the same people are involved, everybody's asking why. It is like the most unlikely target. I mean, I heard it described as, it's like if a bunch of terrorists decided to bomb a library. Why the library? Like, why there? I mean, they're not government affiliated. They're independent. They're nonprofit. They're anti-censorship in that they just archive everything. So it's really hard to have any ideological problem with them. I mean, yes, it gets you attention, but still probably a lot of other targets would get you more attention if that's what you're after. There is a group that has claimed responsibility, although most of the articles I read say that it hasn't been proven yet that they're actually responsible. So people are worried that it's somebody claiming responsibility that didn't actually do it. It's just a very puzzling thing. It's like, why go after them? They're like the nice people.
The only people that I know of that have an issue with archive.org are the big publishing houses.
Yeah.
Who are trying to get them to stop. They're basically fighting it out in court, how archive.org can or cannot loan things out. To be clear, that would be like the least likely group of people to pull together some hackers to say, go take them down.
Exactly. And at least probable in like all sorts of different ways.
Yes.
Like, they wouldn't want to do it. They wouldn't want to get caught. They wouldn't know how to do it. They wouldn't know who to talk to. I mean, you know, it's like the whole thing. It's just a very puzzling thing. And the fact that it's ongoing, I mean, we don't know for sure right now because, you know, Wayback Machine is up, rest of it's down. For all we know, there is no attack going on now, just that they haven't put it back up yet because they're, you know, getting some things so it can't be attacked so easily. Right. But it did certainly go on for days. This wasn't like an attack that happened one evening and then the attacker said, "Oopsie, yeah, that was a dumb target. Let's pick some sort of, capitalist enterprise to attack instead." This just kept going on and on and on. So, yeah, very, very strange, disconcerting. Of course, I use archive.org for things, most notably to I upload all my videos to it for perpetuity, to be up there forever. And I also then use that archive as the podcast feed, which is a like less than like 0.5% of all of my views come through the old video podcast method, which is how MacMost started in 2007. So for the few people that actually want to still view my videos that way for whatever reason, I have that feed point to archive.org's copies of each of these. And of course, so my feed has basically been down, or was down. I started putting those same files in an S3 bucket, just temporarily, so somebody can get the latest video. But I can't continue that because of the cost, to tell you the truth.
Was going to say S3, you're paying both storage cost, which, as it turns out, is not as cost effective as things like even Dropbox. But then you're also paying for bandwidth.
Yeah, bandwidth, and it's very strange. They're not a great bargain on bandwidth that I thought they would be. But the problem is that the one thing that Amazon does with S3 that you can't find as easily as you think you should is they it's a tr it's a it's called a bucket, because that's what it is. I could upload a file to it and then make that file available. Other services that kind of seem like they should compete with it don't. What they do is they are caching stuff. So the idea is I put the file up on my server, and then, but I point to a URL at this content delivery network, which then grabs it from my server and redelivers it, which means you have to do all sorts of magic with DNS, and you've got to store all the files on your own as well, which is just a lot of maintenance when you have a podcast and you've got a new episode and then the old episode drops off the end. And it's like a whole thing. Whereas the S3 bucket is just a upload and here's the URL. It's a pain. So I hope I don't have to continue to use that for very long. I'm tempted, if I needed to find a long-term solution, I'm thinking of just shutting down the podcast completely, because it's like, yeah, so few people use it. And possibly also, I discovered, because the feed wasn't working, like the files couldn't be accessed, that I could simply just continue with the RSS feed, because I think a reason people didn't complain is that the actual entry for each episode was like, here's the description. Oh, if you want to view this on the web, click here. And I think people were just doing that. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Maybe I don't even need to have the file in the RSS feed. I could just have the RSS feed with either a missing file or to like a dummy file, and then just continue to put it there. Apple and iTunes and the podcast app haven't paid any attention to my podcast feed even back in 2007. Why would they start now? So, yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing. But I would like, I have this backlog now of videos I haven't been able to upload to archive.org, that I want to make sure that I have a complete archive there. So I, have to get back to that. But still, just a weird thing to have happen, of all the places to have this happen.
And it's funny because I feel badly for a whole bunch of different people, not just the people down at archive.org, but like Kay, for example, who's doing a bunch of Internet Archive related stuff. I can only assume that he's just blocked from doing anything, unless, and I haven't asked him, but unless he's actually involved in the mitigation. But yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I hope, the only thing I can hope, is that this is raising awareness of archive.org, and that when they get back up, their contributions will increase for the rest of the year,
Be nice.
as more people maybe miss them and say, yeah, and I really should probably. I did actually even see somebody post on a social media network, Does anybody know how I can contribute to archive.org right now?
Yes.
Because their site's down, so I can't get to the contribution thing, but I have a feeling that they really need, you know, a boost right now.
What's interesting, though, is that the answer to that, of course, is now on archive.org, right? The temporary page they've got, very last line there says our
patron, there it is.
They can support, and it's a link to PayPal. So, yeah, sure, do it.
I also found that interesting. As soon as they went offline, officially offline, then they replaced the main page with the, you know, error message service availability thing. And the first thing I saw is that the message looked really old. Like they hadn't actually activated that page in a long time.
Oh, right.
And it said, check at Twitter/X for the latest information. And I was so like disappointed. I was like, oh, come on. That's the only place I could go. I have to go over to that site. And apparently I wasn't the only one that complained because I checked like an hour later and then it said Twitter/X or Blue Sky or Mastodon.
Right.
So I was like, all right, that's better. Give us choices.
Yes, I've been looking at Mastodon. It's been kind of interesting to see things progress.
Indeed.
All righty.
Hey, so I was, of course, we can't go through an episode without talking about AI. So I did something interesting with AI with 11 Labs, which we use for this very podcast for various things. Like a lot of these AI tools now, they're getting multifaceted, right? There's all sorts of cool things that you could do on like the page. Like it's like you can do this. And 11 Labs, of course, specializes in audio and voice and all. And one of the things you can do is you could give it a video and it will produce alternative soundtracks where it translates the spoken word to another language. And it will do it using a similar sounding voice to the original. So to test that out, I actually did that with one of my videos. And I said, give me a Spanish soundtrack. And it sounds like me speaking Spanish. My Spanish teacher from middle school would be so proud.
Is the Spanish any good, though? There's a real question.
Well, that's
right?
The thing. Now, okay, I haven't tested it. I do plan on uploading this version to my patrons because there must be some Spanish speakers there so I can get some feedback. And it's interesting. It seems like there are limitations. Like one of the things it does is it really tries to match up the pacing of the audio through it. So it's not changing anything in the video. Your lips don't change or whatever. It's not doing anything special like that. But it's trying to keep the same pace, but it has a tolerance, I found, because I can look through the whole video and I can see it broken into segments, approximately sentences maybe. And most of them are the same size. And then every once in a while, there's one that's like 25% less. Never like 5% less, never just a little bit, like the Spanish finishes a little bit earlier than the English. But it's always either they match or they're off by like 25%. So I'm thinking that it's like a tolerance thing where it's like if they can make it match, they will. And if not, it just they don't try. So sometimes you're talking and you see my lips continue to move after the Spanish has finished saying,
right.
You know, whatever it is I'm saying. And, you know, it's a couple seconds of me doing it. And other times it's fine. And then I tried, just for the heck of it, I tried adding another soundtrack to it. And I added Hindi as well. And Hindi is not a language I hear spoken very often, unlike Spanish in the United States, which you hear all the time. And it was it was fascinating to hear Hindi, to hear something I don't really, you know, it's very different for me to hear that, but I could hear my voice speaking it. So that was really interesting. And I'm tempted to, I'm going to let my patrons see this, but it's actually really easy to take these and export them as audio. And then YouTube has a way for you to just insert, you know, alternative soundtracks.
Oh, interesting.
For a YouTube video. So I plan on going back to that video and probably throwing these two in there. And that leads to kind of the speculation and thinking that, well, you know, how long before YouTube actually does this automatically, right? That would be really interesting. Oh, I also liked that 11 Labs, it recognizes when there's things that are not spoken word. So when it gets to my little theme music at the beginning,
right,
that plays normal.
Okay.
And at the end too. So it's actually, and then other little sounds that were in the video, little beeps and stuff, they play fine as well. So it's doing more than just grabbing the words generating a new soundtrack and then laying it in. It is actually working very closely with the audio track to do that.
Interesting.
It got me thinking too about, like, for a while, you've kind of had this translator ability on the iPhone, where there's a translate app and you can use it for text and all, but you can also use it, you could speak into it, or if somebody speak into it, and it will show you the text on the screen or speak it to you. And you can even set it into a mode where you put the phone down between you and you can go back and forth. And it acts like a translator in a sci-fi movie. And
Right.
this isn't new, right? This has been around for a few years. So it's really cool. And I've seen a few videos, like travel type videos, where as a matter of course, the person is talking to somebody and they've got their iPhone out. And
Right.
they're just using this to ask for, when does the ferry leave, or, how much does it cost to do this or whatever. And it's because, and they're not even commenting on that they're, oh, look at this cool thing I'm doing. No, it's just like, oh, and then we were on our way to here and we needed to find directions. And then they show that's how they did it. It's fascinating. We definitely have been getting closer to having, kind of universal translators like they have in sci-fi. Which is
Hopefully,
fascinating.
when you don't understand the other language,
Yeah.
hopefully it's not doing the my hovercraft is full of eels.
Yeah, the Monty Python
Right.
thing. Yeah, I mean, there's that. I mean, I guess, yeah, you have to go and, use. I found as I've traveled the world, I was very, when I was younger, because I've always had difficulty learning other languages, I think due to my hearing. I don't have a very a good ear for distinguishing different sounds. And I think that's held me back in learning new languages because I'm not hearing things outside of English sounds very well. That made me very timid about about traveling to countries early on that where it wasn't very common to find somebody who speaks English. But since I, stopped worrying about that and have been doing a lot of traveling, I'm amazed by how rarely you need to actually use language a lot of the time. How you could travel all around, say, Tokyo,
Right.
go to a restaurant, visit a museum, go shopping, and then realize you never really had a language barrier at all because so much is conveyed with just gestures or just actions. You don't you walk up to pay for something, you don't have to say anything. Here's the thing I'm going to buy. You do it, you give your credit card. I'd like, no language is needed, right? Same thing with ordering food in a
It'd be
restaurant
nice to
often.
say thank you, but yes.
But it's like, it's not like it's like, oh, I tried to buy something and I didn't know the language. I couldn't, convey to the person who's there to take my money
Right.
for the products I bring up to the counter, couldn't understand what I wanted. Of course, they could understand what I wanted. It's the same thing everybody else wants that comes up to them to pay for their
Right.
stuff. And so it's very, and also, in like tr public transportation, all that, it's very symbol based, very map based, that kind of thing, gestures, pointing. So even you said it'd be nice to say thank you. But you know what? Smiling,
Of course.
waving, there's a lot of gestures that you could use without words to signify basically thank you or please or general goodwill. But adding a level like this where you can actually maybe have a conversation with somebody and ask them a question that's not normal, it's interesting. And it's kind of been a quiet piece of technology that isn't been talked about much. And AI, of course, helps with it
Well,
a
that,
lot.
and I suspect that even though it's been around for a while, it probably wasn't as good 2 or 3 years ago as it probably is
Oh,
now,
definitely. Yeah.
right?
No, it's
So
getting
it's one
better
of
and
those
better.
things that's just been quietly improving to the point where all of a sudden people like you and I would recognize that, oh, hey, this just became a viable option.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's funny, because in Europe, we've talked about this before too. The symbology makes a lot of sense, right? There's a lot of image-based communication, but it's still the case that, especially in the urban areas, English just works.
Yeah.
It's on one hand, it's sad, right? But on the other hand, it does make things much more convenient. And I've mentioned this before too, that when my relatives who are Dutch go to a foreign country like, say, Denmark or Finland or something like that, just north, the Finnish don't know Dutch, the Dutch don't know Finnish, so they speak in English,
Yes,
which I
yeah, it's
find
true.
very, very interesting and somewhat just funny.
Yep. I've observed that too in some, definitely in Scandinavia. It's very common. So, yeah, it's, one of the things that technology is making the world better, helping us understand, help us travel. But we it's ha it's been happening so smoothly over the last so many years that it hasn't gotten the headlines that other things have gotten.
And honestly, the headlines that it deserves, because this is one of those things where it actually is practical use.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
Yep.
I want to complain.
Okay.
One of the things that, well, let me back up. Facebook is a great target for complaints because they do lots of things badly, right? I mean, they've enabled a global community. I certainly, there's a lot of stuff that wouldn't exist, I suspect, without Facebook. But Facebook seems to be, of late, shooting itself in the foot repeatedly. And I'm not sure that they care. I have had posts removed with, the warning that says, hey, this is spam, yada, yada. Of course, it's not. And of course, these are posts that have been up there for like 3 months or so. They're just now getting around to deciding that it's spam. Of course, I contest or ask for a reevaluation, and I never hear anything. I got one this morning where I got notified that Facebook had taken down 20 of my posts. They were posted this summer, but I have no way of knowing which posts they were.
Oh, wow.
Just because it doesn't handle a long list like that very well. You might ask for show me more information, and it just shows you the same partial list, the same thing. It says, we removed this post 20 times. So, yes, that's my grump. Facebook is removing posts. Now, one of the reasons that I mentioned it here, and one of the things I'm going to go on a little bit of a jihad on Facebook and other socials, is that there's nothing we can do. Complaining doesn't help. Asking for review doesn't seem to help. We are at their mercy. So if you don't want to miss posts from Ask Leo, from MacMost, from Not All News Is Bad, one of my other ones, Seven Takeaways, all those things, sign up for the newsletter. The newsletter is under our control. With the exception of spam filters, which ultimately are still under our control, in the sense that we can actually do things to understand what's going on, it's the most reliable way to stay in contact with whatever service or site you're interested in following. So, anyway, that's my little grump turned active. I don't know what you want to call it, but sign up for the email lists. Get Facebook out of the way. If this continues to happen with Facebook, I'm not sure if I'm going to keep trying to invest over there just because it's so frustrating to do all that and then have it removed.
Yeah, I've stopped posting regularly to Facebook for MacMost a long time ago. And I wonder too if some of this it doesn't excuse it, but some of it is maybe spam has gotten a lot worse because I noticed about a month or so ago that I did a periodic check into my junk filter for email. And I'm using Google. I'm using like a Google Workspace, email address for my primary thing. And they charge for it now. So if I had to start over again, I probably would use like ProtonMail or something like that. But since I'm already there at Google, I'll just keep going. But I usually look in junk to see some good examples of spam and scams that I could use in my videos, right? And I've been doing, I did a really good video on scams recently, and I'm planning to do more. So I was looking in it to see, okay, oh, let me go and see if I can get some good juicy lottery scam examples in here, because I was doing some research on that. And I found a lot more false positives in there than I was prepared to see, because
Oh, really?
usually I rarely see a false positive in there. And to the point where I don't even go. It's like, if there's the occasional email that falls in there, if it was important, the person would contact me another way. But I saw a lot of, number one, regular messages to me from people. Some stuff that was like server related stuff, where it was like the server telling me things, and it wasn't important, but it should not have been marked as spam. It should have just gone in my inbox, and I should have just archived it, you know?
Server ones I have an explanation for, but go ahead.
Well, but they were not, it wasn't a very consistent thing. Like things like a con, like I'd get a couple comment notifications. And I was like, well, I'm getting all the rest of the comment notifications. These went to spam, though. And then just a few other just odd, just weird things. So I basically went in, fortunately, with Google, you can set lots of filtering rules. And
Yes.
all of these, basically, I was able to go and create filtering rules I just didn't need before, like
Right.
stuff that, WordPress comment notifications just didn't go to spam. So I didn't never had to do it, but it was easy to go and set it up so that if certain criteria were met, always go to the inbox and never send to spam. So I set up a bunch of rules and that worked and all. But it was just weird because it's like, well, there must be a little bit of a few battles in the war going on for them to have upped the stakes a bit. And my stuff got
Right.
caught up in it.
Right.
All right.
So this week in cool stuff, I'm going to do something really odd. My cool thing is going to be technology related. For the most part, we've been avoiding technology in this section, but it dawned on me this morning that I've been relying on a little piece of technology for, gosh, a couple of years now that has really, really been serving me well. And it's a TP-Link Wi-Fi extender. And the reason I bring it up is because, as you know, I was out of town this weekend. And when we do that, we go out in our travel trailer, be it at a park or at, in this case, a relative's. Yes, there's Wi-Fi in the area, but it's often very, very weak. And I've even had this where I've left one specifically with a relative in their home because they too were having trouble accessing the Wi-Fi that was available to them. And it's awesome. I was expecting there to be more issues. I even had a Zoom call yesterday or the day before using, I mean, went over the Wi-Fi extender. I was concerned that it would add more latency to the connection, but it's as if it weren't there at all. So I just wanted to throw that out there for folks that are having Wi-Fi issues, especially when it's related to signal strength. TP-Link Wi-Fi extender. My theory is that because it is designed to be an extender, it has a better antenna specifically for receiving than is, crammed into my laptop. So yeah, it's actually been working really well. And I just wanted to recommend that to folks. The links will be in the show notes.
I am really excited about my Ain't It Cool this week.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite books of recent years. I devoured it this week. Have you ever heard of you probably have heard of books, somebody describes it as, hey, this book is really Douglas Adams-like.
Right.
And then you read the book and you're like, okay, so Douglas Adams-like means it's sci-fi and there are a couple jokes. Which is not this, that's not it. And it is every time that there's a little bit of humor in a sci-fi book, somebody says this is like Douglas Adams, and no, it always fails. So when I saw that for this book, the only thing that actually got me to read it is it's from an author I know that is top-notch. This is a book by Adrian Tchaikovsky, who's written some fantastic, deep, and very serious sci-fi. So when I heard he wrote a book that was extremely Douglas Adams-like, I thought, that's interesting. He writes really serious stuff, like deep stuff. And I started listening to this, and boy, finally, a book that is very Douglas Adams-like. To be a Douglas Adams-like book, it's not just has to be sci-fi and funny, but the humor has to be really rooted in technology and bureaucracy. Right, which is a theme throughout Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's
Yes.
really a series about bureaucracy, right? And it's got to be constant. Hitchhikers doesn't let up. It
Right.
doesn't give you a funny chapter at the beginning of the book, and then now let's get serious and save the world. It keeps going, and it's just as ridiculous at the end as it is at the beginning. This book is just like that. It's sci-fi, it's funny, the humor is about technology and bureaucracy, And it keeps it up the entire book. It does not let down on the humor at all. It's a book called Service Model. It's fantastic. It's actually kind of a dystopian novel where the main character is a robot, a valet robot. And the premise is at the very beginning of the book, just to give you a sample, the very beginning of the book, he kills his master, slits his throat, and doesn't know why he did it. And when the police bot comes around to investigate the crime, he confesses, which the police bot says, confessions can be faked or coerced. And he's like, "Oh, but I'm telling you, I did it." And he says, "Well, I'm going to investigate and find out who really did it," and then determines he's not guilty because he has no motive, because he can't explain why he killed his master. So without a motive, there can't be a murder, according to my programming. And he gets to go free. And the whole book is just this ridiculousness of this robot that is built to be a valet, going out into this world, which turns out not to exist anymore outside of this, the last little mansion that he was working in. And going through and encountering ridiculous people, ridiculous robots, bureaucracy just gone completely awry, spiraling out of control. It's bizarre, and every line is just dripping with just humor, and it's just delicious. The whole thing is just delicious, and it's like I could not stop reading it, but at the same time, I hated the fact that I was getting through it so fast because then the book would be over. So, anyway, it's a great book. Huge
Well,
recommendation.
darn you for adding something else to my reading list. By the way, I did want to comment on the fact that I have been reading last week's recommendation.
Yes.
I'm starting to worry about this black box of doom.
I saw that in your newsletter. Yeah.
And yes, and I'm about three quarters of the way through it and concur with your recommendation. It's a really interesting, fascinating story, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it all resolves.
Cool.
Self-promotion.
Yeah.
So the article that I am going to self-promote is Passkey two-factor authentication? We've talked about passkeys occasionally here, and the fact that you and I basically have a really hard job ahead of us to try and
Yeah.
explain what it is and get people to adopt it and so forth. But one of the common confusions is it two-factor authentication? Does it relate to two-factor authentication? And of course, the traditional answer is, well, it depends. There are it's not, but occasionally, sometimes it kind of sort of is. Anyway, askleo.com/174464 is passkey two-factor authentication. We'll attempt to make the mud a little less muddy.
I'll point to a video, things you could do with an Apple trackpad that you can't do with a mouse. One of the best things Apple makes is their trackpads. They're built into all the MacBooks, but you can also buy a standalone one for desktop machines. It's a really great device, and the comments for this video actually proved me kind of right that people that use the trackpad really do love it. And people that don't use it just haven't tried it. Like a lot of people just go and say, I think I like a mouse. I'll go with a mouse. And they just don't give the trackpad a chance. So anyway, I point out some actual like specific things you can do with it, functions that it does that a mouse doesn't do.
Cool. Yeah, my current frustration with my laptop is that it's a not a Mac, obviously, but its trackpad is super, super sensitive, and I don't seem to have a way to dial that down, so it's very easy for me to accidentally, quote unquote, click on things I didn't mean to click on. Alrighty, cool. Well, here we are. That ought to wrap it up again for another week. As always, thank you for listening, and we will see you real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye.
The show notes for this week are at tehpodcast.com/teh233. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.